This is Phil Farron. And I am driving around. It's kind of a sad thing. Not really driving home at all anymore. Because I'm already at home. Now, you know, how would I ever know in... When did I start this podcast? 2009, I think, when I started this podcast, that I would not be driving home in 2026. 17 years later, 15, 16 years? I don't know when I started the podcast, but it's been a while. But you know, life is funny like that. So anyways, still not doing any writing, still getting more and more kind of antsy about that, but there is a plan, and I know that once I get past Goth Day coming up, I know that the writing's going to start pretty quick after that, and the first book is going to be pretty easy, so I'll be able to ease back into it. Actually, the writing won't start after that because the beta versions will start coming back in. They have started coming back in, the beta versions of book 24, and the rest of them should be in by June 1st, and then basically the first two or three weeks of June are going to be writing, but they'll be finishing up on book 24. So, got to get that all put together. And then probably I'm going to put in the changes for the covers just quickly. And then there's a couple of books in the series that I couldn't get automated audio turned on for in Kindle Direct Publishing. So I'll have to investigate that and get that taken care of. And then batten down all those hatches. And so probably by the end of July, maybe by the end of July, pretty much have all of that under control. And, you know, then maybe I can start on Still Whispers, The Life's Prayer, early July. It's called The Life's Prayer. I don't know if I've described that before, but it's on the Lord's Prayer. And it's all about taking the Lord's Prayer and taking the phrases and applying them to your life so that as you move through the day and you're facing decision points, you can reach for a phrase of the Lord's Prayer to determine what's the best path, what is the best path forward. And calling it the Life's Prayer, it certainly does not roll off the tongue. But it is one of those things that visually, if you understand what's being said, it will make sense even though it's difficult to pronounce. So Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so this is his prayer, and it applies to our lives. And so it is the Life's Prayer. So that's that. That's all going fine. I am pushing AI image generation to kind of the limit of what it's capable of. I may have already started this and mentioned this, but I am going to break up the three sets of books and try to visually approximate some representation of the poem. And so I got the basic ideas done. Now is implementing. Because it's one continuous picture, it's hard to fudge this. And I don't want to do any editing and try to fudge this, because it's just going to be difficult, because there's... For instance, on the first picture that is the conviction opus, the poem starts out turning and turning in the widening gyres. And so there is across the entire image on the spine of the first book, there's kind of a swirl in the clouds. They're fractal clouds at this point, which I'm not sure about that. We'll see after I get all the placements done. And the spirals of those fractal clouds stretch across the entire image, which means that if every book isn't lined up just right, it's going to show pretty easily. It's going to show. So the difficulty then is getting the key elements lined up correctly to where they land on the spines that they're supposed to be on. That has been a bit of an adventure, but I found that if I keep ChatGPT just focused on the active area, because I'm really only taking the top third, top whatever it would be, fourth, no, top third, top, maybe it is third. It's 3.75 and it's across 9, so it's about the top third, not quite. I'm taking that top third, that's really the only active area where I'm trying to do this panorama. And if I just have ChatGPT focus on that, then everything gets scaled correctly. If I try to tell it, only put the active elements in the top third, it doesn't work. So anyways, I learned that trick, and then I also learned a trick where ChatGPT is really going to struggle to create a balanced image, even if I say, no, don't worry about that. Which, for instance, speaking of the spiral, I kept trying to tell it, okay, when you create this spiral, it needs to be all the way against the left side of the image, and it's okay if you chop off the left side to where we can't see the left side of that. And it would just keep putting the full spiral in there. And with the full spiral in there, there's no way that the center is going to end up on the center of that first spine. So finally, I just said, okay, instead of generating for 8.8 inches, just go ahead and generate for 9.25 inches. And so that gives it space to allow it to do the full spiral over there. And then I'm just going to lop it off. That first image ends with a frightened woman, the best lack all conviction, and an angry man, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I worked for quite a while to get that stuff lined up. Boy. I kept saying, no, okay, no, put it a little bit to the left, put it a little bit to the right, right, now move both of them to the right, and what, no. Okay, no. But eventually, I landed on an image that will work. So I have a template with the sizes of all the spines, and then between each of the books, there's a 0.07 band of black that represents the spacing that you're going to get between spines, because the spine is compressed, but the pages beyond that spine are going to fluff out a little bit. And so you're going to get this, even if you put the books side by side, you're going to get that little gap between the physical spines itself. And so I measured that, plus I talked to ChatGPT about it, and I said, what would you estimate this fluff is here? And so it said it would typically estimate it in. It said it just depends on the type of paper you have and those kind of things, but it estimated it in at 0.07, which is functionally, what, 16th of an inch approximate. 16th of an inch is 0.0625. So it estimated in there, great. So I'm working on that. I'm trying to get those spines all done. If once I get those spines all done, then I can take the pictures and say, don't change anything. Just take the bottom of the picture and expand it out with just rough terrain, you know, to 9.25 inches. And so that's easily done. And if it won't do it, Gigapixel certainly will do it. Gigapixel AI. which is what I use for all my upscaling. It's good. It does a good job. Anyway, so, you know, that's all going fine. The costumes are going fine. I think I'm all ready to go for Talk Like Yoda Day tomorrow. And hopefully I'll be able to do all these deep knee bends. I think so. I practiced a little bit today, and I did not three or four in a row, but I did one and then fiddled around, did another one, fiddled around, did another one. And that's the good thing about this. I'm not actually going to be bouncing up and down, bouncing up and down, bouncing up and down, you know, 30 in a row. Cause I'll be gabbing and, you know, I'll do one and hopefully people will laugh and think it's funny. And then I'll stand up and I'll go, you know, it'll be a good 30 seconds, 30, 45 seconds, couple of minutes until I have to do another one. So should be fine. I'm going to move this because it's wheedled to the side a little bit. There we go. So that'll all be fun. I think. I hope people find it amusing. We'll see. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll have the little guy tomorrow for breakfast, but we'll have pancakes and get together with some friends tomorrow. And, you know, then just going to the Walmart and kicking around. So life is good. Life is good. I did come across a video, and the video was not really saying anything that I didn't already know, but it was a good reminder and kind of, I guess that is right. That's right, you know, type of a thing. And it was comparing 1970s America to today. And specifically from a weight perspective. Specifically from a physical capability perspective. And it was interesting to hear the stats again. Because I think it's easy, it's easy for me to vilify certain things that I do believe are responsible for a lot of our problems. Ultra-refined foods, which are high in carbohydrates and all kinds of weird stuff. Sugar, specifically. It's easy to vilify that stuff. And just think, everybody needs to cut that all out and never eat any of that stuff. But what this podcast or this YouTube video reminded me is that people were eating that stuff in the 70s. And yet, as it starts out, and it says, look at any candid photograph from the 1970s, whether it's a crowded beach or a school cafeteria or a shopping mall or a city sidewalk. And if you're paying attention at all, there's something immediate that jumps out to modernize. Almost no one appears obese. Almost no one. Not the athletes, not just the young people. Everyone seems thinner. The dads, the moms, the grandparents. But those people were not living on kale smoothies and protein shakes. And that's true. They ate hamburgers, they drank Coca-Cola, they went to McDonald's, they ate white bread, butter, potatoes, and red meat. And somehow, the obesity rates were dramatically lower. So how? Why? And bear in mind, I am 67, which Aiden just loves it when I remind him of that. He's because he's still on the 6'7 thing. And so he keeps saying, 6'7, 6'7. I'll say, I'm 6'7. And for a while he was saying, that's not true. And I'd say, yes, it is. And he said, if you don't stop saying that, I'm going to call 119. And I tell him, you just call 119 if you want to. But then his new thing now is I don't know where he picks it up from school, probably. Because now he's saying 6'7", 6'7", and I'll say, I'm 6'7", that's me. And he'll go, bruh. So anyways, since I am 67, I lived through the 70s. Now, I was in the Philippines for most of it. I was back in the States by 76, but you know, this is true. I mean, when I was growing up in the Philippines, now the Philippines is a little different. There were all missionary kids, and there were very few overweight missionary kids. There certainly were very, very few overweight Filipinos because they didn't have much food to eat. But it was starches. I mean, they lived on rice, and they were still not overweight. Pretty much the only overweight people that we encountered were rich kids. And those rich kids, the vast majority of the time, were obnoxious. And so it was a little struggle for me once I came back to the States and the obesity rate started to rise, because it just kind of triggered those memories, you know, of obnoxious, overweight children. But anyway, so the question is, what happened? You know, this podcast was asking, did America suddenly lose discipline over the last 50 years? Did human biology change? Or did something deeper shift in the structure of everyday life? So it goes on to say that the video is about culture, technology, convenience, and the invisible systems that shape human behavior. So they review the numbers for the obesity epidemic. It's one of the most dramatic public health transformations. In the early 70s, roughly 13% of American adults were classified as obese. Today, that number is over 40%. That means obesity has nearly tripled in about 50 years. And what makes this fascinating is that the rise happened gradually enough that many people barely noticed it happening. There wasn't one single moment where everything changed. Hundreds of small changes accumulated. Slightly larger soda, slightly larger plate, a few more snacks, a little less walking, a little more sitting, a little more convenience. All of these things. So, for instance, in the 70s, dinner usually came from the kitchen. Not DoorDash, Uber Eats, not from a microwave tray, not from a drive-thru. Cooking at home was simply the default. And the fact is, if you cook something at home, it is more healthy for you, unquestionably, than anything you're going to buy in a box. Period. Meals were repetitive and practical, but built around stretching ingredients. So a roast chicken on Sunday became soup on Monday, sandwiches on Tuesday. Nothing got wasted. Food wasn't optimized for novelty. It wasn't engineered for hyperpalatability. It wasn't designed by a marketing department. It was just food. And the portions were limited. So if someone spent an hour cooking dinner, there usually wasn't an unlimited amount available. You ate what was prepared, and when dinner was over, it was over. And I thought, oh yeah, that's right. There wasn't second delivery around 10 p.m. There wasn't emergency frozen pizza. There wasn't an endless stream of snacks options. The kitchen effectively closed after dinner. Now, food is functionally infinite. You can obtain highly rewarding calories at every hour of the day with almost zero effort. So the next thing is the portion size. Coca-Cola in 1970, a regular Coke, regular, not small, not large, regular, was 7 ounces. Today, a medium Coke is around 21 ounces, and a large may exceed 30 ounces. That's not a small difference. And it's several hundred calories more. Hamburgers, the original hamburger, weighed in at 1.6 ounces. Today's hamburgers are dramatically larger. And then there's the plate. A typical dinner plate in the 70s was roughly 9 inches across. Modern plates are closer to 12 inches. Larger plates, you have to fill them. So humans unconsciously use visual cues to determine how much food feels normal. Larger plate, larger servings, more calories without even thinking about it. It's called the portion size effect. There was also a massive shift involving meal frequency. In many households during the 1970s, there were 3 meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Snacking existed, but it wasn't constant. Today, many Americans consume calories continuously. Coffee drinks, which are loaded with sugar, protein bars, snack packs, sodas, energy drink, desserts, late-night snacks. Modern culture, food culture has erased the experience of being mildly hungry. But historically, there were short periods between meals. And physiologically, those gaps matter. Insulin level falls, digestive processes reset, total calorie intake often decreases naturally. But, of course, the people in the 70s were not doing intermittent fasting. But the structure of life created eating windows that were more metabolically restrained than the modern patterns. And today, food isn't merely nutrition. It's comfort, stress release, convenience, background stimulation, cultural shifts. In addition, the movement of childhood has been lost. When I grew up in the Philippines in the 70s, I was outside all the time. Got home from school, went outside. You know, climbed trees, ran around, went down to the pond, gigged frogs. I mean, picked fruit out of trees. You know, we were just all around all the time. I mean, we didn't have baseball because there was only me and a little Filipino kid that I played with, Danny Esperanza. But, you know, we climbed around and walked across the campus. It was a 70-hectare campus and all that stuff. And nobody organized us. We just got out and did it. Physical activity was simply woven into daily life. But now kids are spending more time indoors, screen exposure, less independent mobility, less spontaneous play. The children in those 70s weren't working out. They weren't trying to burn calories. They just moved. That was part of life. They moved. You know, they didn't set aside an hour at the gym. So, and that kind of low-level daily activity, walking, standing, climbing, biking, adds up massively over time. This was interesting. Researchers called this NEAT, N-E-A-T, non-exercise activity thermogenesis. In other words, you can burn calories just by moving. And then, of course, if you opened a refrigerator in 1975, you'd be likely to see ingredients. Milk, bread, eggs, butter, leftovers, cheese, soup, meat. Open refrigerators today and you see ready-to-consume products. Snack packs, sugary yogurts, energy drink, desserts, prepared meals, ultra-processed convenience foods. And that stuff is not good for you. Of course, there's then also sugar and the high fructose corn syrup era. So, there's that. I've got to pick up Aiden here, so I got to. Because you can drink hundreds of calories and still feel like you're hungry. So, obesity is really multifactorial. You know, it involves the fact that calories are available, the food has been engineered to be hyperpalatable, people are getting less sleep, they're stressed, they're not getting enough activity, There's a psychology involved because you're getting dopamine hits. There's economics involved because the cheap stuff is the stuff that's really not good for you. If you're buying packaged foods, there are a way to do that. And then, of course, if you have a problem, you can go get medicated. And there's all kinds of social structures to distract you. So there is, of course, the issue that daily life required more effort in the 70s. Now, daily life has become easier. In the 70s, there were more physical jobs, people walked more, chores required more effort, appliances were less automated, suburbs were less sprawling. But now we work seated, we drive seated, we get our entertainment seated, we're just seated. And of course, fast food changed as well. For many families in the 70s, fast food was occasional, a treat, a reward, a special outing. Not an everyday default. And the meals were smaller and simpler. There was no supersizing, no giant combo meals, no endless refill cultures. But everything's been engineered at this point. Sugar, fat, salt, texture, aroma, convenience. So according to this podcast, the inflection point appears to be somewhere around the 1980s. I got to wrap this up. Multiple trends converge simultaneously. More processed food, larger portions, more television, more sedentary entertainment, more dual-income household, less home cooking, more snack foods, more convenience culture, more delivery systems, more food marketing. None of those individually are catastrophic, but they all add up. Now, granted, there were problems in the 70s. Higher smoking rates, less knowledge about nutrition, less more environmental toxins, there were social inequities, and yes, there were overweight people. But modern life increasingly separates human from the conditions under which human metabolism evolved. Constant food availability, minimum movement, infinite stimulation, hyper-palatable engineered foods. Those things are historically unprecedented. Unprecedented, and human biology is poorly adapted. So, you know, what do we do about all this? I think you just have to recognize all this stuff is going on and find some ways to constrain yourself. Fasting. I've found fasting to be very effective at this. Even if it's just intermittent fasting, where it's a you know, like a 16-8 or something like that, where you only eat for 8 hours a day. For me, it's staying away from carbs, staying away from sugars, regular exercise, try to get good sleep. All these things may mean something. I got to go get Aiden. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it to the end of this podcast. I will see you next week. Do 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 do